Game on.
Game on.
2FM.
And you're very welcome to Game On here on 2FM. It's Hugh Cal with you until 8 o'clock tonight. It's Friday night. We're all looking forward to the weekend that's to come. We're going to talk rugby in a few minutes' time with Reggie Corrigan, Kevin Palmer on the weekend's Premier League action, racing with Liam Nash and Johnny Ward, and we have the Punters Council as well. 51552 for your text messages at Game On 2FM on Twitter. And Alan Colley is with me in the studio. You're very welcome, Alan Colley.
Thanks very much, Hugh.
Looking forward to the weekend.
I am as well.
Lots to talk about tonight.
Well, a massive sporting weekend, Hugh. When you see what's on offer on Sunday, it's whopper.
Yeah.
That's the only way to describe it.
The two big games in the Premier League, we have Arsenal, Man United, we have the Merseyside Derby, we have Ireland up against Italy, and what is their toughest test so far? We have the Arc, the triumph.
I forgot about the Arc, actually. Yeah, There's that much on, I forgot about it. Well, Atletico Madrid, Real Madrid Sunday night as well.
And Super Sunday in Tipperary, Robbie says, that which is the highlight for him. Nearly for me, Rob. Nearly for me. Yeah, so, loads to talk about between now and 8 o'clock. We'd love to hear from you. As I said, 51552 for your text messages. We want to go straight over to Tomlin Park, though, because there is a game in the Pro 12 between Munster and last season's champions, the Glasgow Warriors. Half time at the moment, and Pat McAuliffe is there. Hiya, Pat.
Yes, second half just started, Hugh. It's cold here at Tomlin Park, but it's 13-9 to Munster, and Munster came from behind to lead here at the break. It's not a great match, I can tell you, and it's also bitterly cold. I know people around Limerick probably know that already, and the lights have been on the dull evenings at 6 o'clock, but looking back at the match so far in that first half, Munster went behind after 13 minutes when Rory Clegg put over a penalty for the Glasgow side. Glasgow, of course, remember, won the Pro 12 last year when they defeated Munster in the final back in May in Belfast. But Munster replied here after 20 minutes. Ian Keatley putting over a penalty. And then Dave O'Callaghan, big Dave O'Callaghan, went over after constant Munster pressure on the half-hour mark. And that try was converted by Keatley. Clegg then replied with a couple of penalties to make the score 10-9. But right on half-time, Ian Keatley from the halfway line put over the best kick of the night so far to give Munster this 13-9 advantage here at Tomlin Park. There was pointed out, of course, here in this match tonight, Munster come into the game as 2-7 favourites, and you might say why, because they were beaten in the Pro 12 final. Well, of course, there's five of the Munster squad involved in the Irish World Cup squad, but there are 20 of the Scots of the Glasgow squad in World Cup duty. But, it should be a Munster victory, but they're only 4 points ahead, and the second half is on. We've played 43 minutes here at Tomlin Park, and it's Munster 10, Glasgow, or Munster 13, Glasgow 9. I might point out, lads, by the way, Super Sunday, don't forget the FAI Cup semi-final at the Carlisle Grounds.
We wouldn't forget that, Pat, being a proud Cork man yourself. Good stuff. We'll check in with you in about 15 minutes' time. The handicap is 12 points, by the way, because Glasgow are missing 75 players to the Scottish World Cup, and Munster are at home and a pretty strong squad. If you back the handicap in Ulster, you're already out of sight. They're 27-0 up against Benetton Treviso at Ravenhill, or the old Ravenhill, what is now the Kingspan Stadium. Okay, we're going to move on, though, because were you watching the golf today?
I didn't see any of the golf today, no, but I've seen the scores. So our boy, he's doing well again.
Our boy is flying it. Yeah, no, he's brilliant. I mean, of course, a brilliant round yesterday, but it was interesting to see how he'd deal with today, the second round in. Obviously, he was on a high after yesterday, 800 par, superb round.
Going back to the Open, Hugh, I suppose, and we all spoke about how obviously he made his name at the Open, but in terms of going forward and the experiences that he would have gotten from that final day, this is exactly now where that will come into play. Obviously going out today, leading the tournament again, and how he'd handle that, and I think he's coped quite well.
Well, let's find out how he's coped, because Nick Dye knows a lot better than us. He's at the course at the moment. Hi, Nick.
Hello.
Harry, listen, Paul Dunn is a friend of the show. We've had him in a few times here. He's a member of my local club, and we're all eyes on him. He did pretty well today, I think.
We think he's coped superbly well, and it's a manner of his ambition and self-belief that he's that little bit disappointed that he didn't make a birdie at the last to break 70. Still, it was very tidy golf, some very nice putting involved, a huge putt at the fifth. He couldn't even figure it out, but it was in yardage as opposed to feet, and he nestled it close, tapped in for a birdie there, holed a 20-footer at the 10th as well. Probably a few misgivings because there are opportunities that he didn't take, but it's been pretty windy today. He's still up there. He's 10 under par. It's only one stroke shy of his Walker Cup teammate Jimmy Mullen and Anthony Wall. So very tidy position and very positive ahead of the toughest of the courses, Carnoustie, tomorrow.
Yeah, because Carnoustie, I think yesterday on the European Tour, was playing the hardest of the three. Is that the same today?
Pretty much, absolutely. There's been rounds, say, of 63 from Bradley Dredge up at King's Barnes today. St Andrews has had a modicum of good ones in the wind. But there has been, what, a 67 at Carnoustie, with Canizares doing nicely there. So there are scores to be made at Carnoustie, but you do tend to feel, of course, that that is the toughest of the three tracks. So if you look down a leaderboard, you'd probably say those guys that have already played that course and are moving on, say, to St Andrews tomorrow, they're probably the best positioned on the leaderboard. But Paul Dunn's very positive. Likewise, Jimmy Mullen at the top, very used to playing Carnoustie as well, reveling in the fact that it's another Lynx course in pristine condition. So there's no reason to suspect that they'll slip away.
And interestingly, Nick, I was talking to Gary Murphy, who's on the show with us most times here on Game On, but he mentioned that if Paul, or Jimmy for that matter, managed to finish in the top three, they'll automatically get their card for next season. They can kiss goodbye to Q School, which would be incredible.
It's such a lucrative tournament that plenty of players in the history of the European Tour, Rory McIlroy, for instance, had such a very positive performance here. You get the job done, and you'll know with Padraig Harrington, effectively, he secured the race to Dubai, as it was, the Order of Merit in that times, with his victory at it, because it is big money. It's obviously unique. It's that little bit different having the Pro-Am format and playing three courses over 3 days. You don't necessarily appreciate its magnitude until you come to the Sunday and see the way that it does battle out in front of the old clubhouse on the old course. And it's a glorious tournament, and it is hugely significant, particularly as well for others with the run-in to the end of the season, like Peter Lorry as well. A good week here would secure his playing rights for next year.
Okay, Nick, thanks so much for your time. Before we leave the golf, we're just going to have a little listen to what Paul Dunn had to say, speaking to Nick after his round today. Here he is.
You know, I would have liked to break 70, make that putt on the last, but just slip by the right-hand side. It was weird. I played number 1 and 2 into the wind and number 17 and 18 into the wind as well, just the way I timed it. So a bit unfortunate that way. I'm sure you could have hit the 18th green earlier in the day. But, yeah, I was happy. You know, I didn't play well at the start, but held it together, you know, made some good scores. I was doing well to be 2 under through 10, really, without hitting too many good shots. But I played well then from there on in. I just didn't take any of the chances I gave myself. But yeah, 2 under is a decent score. I would have liked a few lower, but yeah, good position going into the weekend.
Okay, that's Paul Dunn after his round today. My thanks to Nick Doyle as well at the course, and hopefully he can keep it going, because this is a 3-round event before the cut is made, and then the last round on Sunday at St Andrews.
That's brilliant, Hugh, especially his first professional tournament is phenomenal, and it's great to see him doing so well, because he's such a likeable lad as well. And even listening to him speak there, he sounds like a seasoned campaigner. That's one thing that always, even the night we were in, how yeah. composed he is, how relaxed he is.
Gets that from me.
I think so, yeah. All them years you were playing with him down in Wicklow, but no, it's great to see him doing well. Hopefully he can keep going for the weekend.
Robbie says you must be joking. Robbie has actually played golf with me, so he knows how bad I am.
Happy Gilmore golf.
Everything. Happy Gilmore. Don't forget the cream and the crop comes in the text. The Wicklow Intermediate Football Final, Ballymanus versus Ratneu this weekend. Yeah, Ratneu are in the Intermediate and in the Senior Final, so they're cleaning up down there.
Hot bit of Gaelic really. Football, Ratneu.
Absolutely. I tell you, they beat our Ogue in the semi-finals. Anyway, we won't go on about that. Big weekend in the Premier League, as I said to you. And Arsene Wenger today, well, didn't so much throw his toys out of the pram, but he certainly wasn't happy with the line of questioning that the journalists were pursuing. And he did lose his cool a bit, which is unusual for Arsene Wenger.
It is unusual for him, but he seems like a very grumpy person at the moment, Hugh. And yeah, I don't know. I'm looking at the football at the moment, and to me, there's serious problems all over the place. I looked at Liverpool last night. It was so poor. And just the standard in general. Like, we've seen United have obviously got to the top of the table, but they haven't convinced me at all. And to me, they just seem like the best of a bad bunch at the moment. There seems to be problems at all the clubs. But just the general standard overall, it's so poor. And
listen,
you
how love your football.
Absolutely live for football.
So why is it not floating your boat at the moment?
I'm not sure. Well, the biggest gripe I've had in the last few years is the money, and the money that's come into it. Now, I know it's a business and people point to Sky Sports and this, that and the other, whatever's involved. But just in terms of the wages and the players, and for what the clubs are getting in return for what they're actually paying out. Now, it's their fault for paying it out, but it's just horrendous, I think, the standard. It's gone so poor. And it's also gone to the point, I think, that money has taken away the passion and the affiliation.
This is what I wanted to get at.
The affiliation that supporters have and the link. There's a total disconnect between it, the normal Joe Soap supporter and the modern day Premiership footballer, because of the money that's involved. And there's no passion in terms of, like, I often go back to when United played Liverpool over the years, the rivalry. You would have had Kane, Gerrard, Neville, Carragher, these fellas who would die for the jersey, die for the club, because that was their team. There's nothing like that now. There's no passion involved. Players are hugging and kissing in the dressing rooms or in the tunnel beforehand, swapping jerseys at half time. There's a list of things you could go through, and it's just, I've lost the love. I really have.
You see, this is what I wanted to get at, because very interesting piece that I read during the week, I can't remember in which paper it was, but basically outlined one of the reasons, the key reasons why Premier League clubs are struggling in Europe at the moment, and chief among them is average players earning massive money coming into the league, not really caring about the club that they're with. They're just there, they're doing their job, they're doing it sufficiently, but they're not really, you know, winning any plunders for fans, or they're actually making, or they're not making any connection, I should say, with the players around them. And it's just leading to a bit of a stale atmosphere among supporters.
It is. For, I suppose when Barcelona were dominating the a few years ago, and I remember they played United around Wembley, and I was looking at the football, and to me back then I always seen it having problems, Hugh, in terms of the technical side for the English teams, because they were a million miles off. And then you could see that being transferred as soon as the national team went into playing to the big tournaments, because England never do well in the big tournaments. And that was coming back to a technical side of things and a possession based game where I always felt they struggled. As you make the point now with the money that's involved, they pay out so much in England, and as you said there, they're not getting the return in terms of the standard and the quality of player, and that's why I think they're struggling in Europe now. Like, you see Man City and United struggling against Wolfsburg and Borussia Mönchengladbach, and like, I don't know, and Arsenal at home to Olympiacos, and they're getting beat by Olympiacos. Like, it's just, I don't know, I'm looking at the, even I watched the games on a Saturday, I watched Chelsea against Newcastle Saturday evening, and Newcastle, everybody knows the problems they have and the dreadful start they've had. Chelsea were horrendous against them. Horrendous. Like, not even ordinary or not average. Horrendous.
Let's go back to Arsenal, because, as I mentioned, he was a bit cranky in his press conference today. Didn't like the line of questioning. This is what he had to say. Have a listen.
Do you accept that when you look at your squad in the summer and you think we only need to strengthen in one area, which is the goalkeeper, and when it comes to a competition in the Champions League that you want to improve upon, when you don't use the guy that you think improves your squad in that, that the fans will be frustrated and angry? Do you understand that?
No, not at all.
Why?
Because I make the decision I think is right on the day.
You said after the game that you sort of inferred that you aren't accountable to people for your selection. Do you think you should be accountable? Is it healthy that you're not?
I'm accountable on the results of my team and the way we play football.
Do you think you should be more accountable for the fans on selection issues, or you don't see that as a valid argument?
I just gave you the answer.
If you're not accountable in that way, does that not make Jose Mourinho right when he says that there's only one manager that's under pressure, that there's only one manager that's not under pressure?
Look, stop that story, or we stop the press conference. Have you another question?
I just wondered if you'd made a decision. Does it work game by game? Or?
Look, we have 2 days training. Do not come always back with that same story. I think you lack a bit creativity in the press at the moment, and you follow a bandwagon that is very, 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 very boring.
Well, it is interesting to see who's in goal, if it's Cech or Ospina. What are the challenges?
Come to the game on Sunday, you will see who is in the goal.
There's Arsene Wenger. Kevin Palmer, you're very welcome.
How you doing, guys? How's things?
Yeah, not too bad. It's good to talk to you. You were at that press conference today, am I right?
I was indeed, yes. Very feisty occasion it was.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you don't actually hear Arsene Wenger lose the head too often like that, so I suppose that's what got our attention first of all. But I didn't think the line of questioning was particularly out of order. He did start his second choice keeper after bringing in Petr Cech in a key home game in the Champions League, and they were beaten because of that decision that he made. Ultimately, you know, the keeper didn't do the business. So questions were perfectly fine as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, you know, I've covered Wenger. I believe it, I'm old enough to have been at his first press conference. I've probably done 500 since, and I think it's the only time he's ever threatened to walk out of a press conference. He had one feisty exchange with a journalist before a Bayern Munich Champions League game a few years back, but this was the first time he's actually threatened to walk out. And I think even though the questions about Ospina were fine, I think bringing in the Jose Mourinho thing, the guy from Sky Sports, Andy Burnham, I think he knew what he was doing, because And those of us that go to Wenger press conferences every week will tell you that there's one subject he doesn't want to talk about, is Jose Mourinho and his comments. And I think if the questions had stayed with Ospina and why he dropped him, even though he was getting a little bit annoyed by them because it was so persistent, I think the issue of bringing in Mourinho into it instantly inflamed the situation. And it was almost like throwing a grenade onto his desk. And he got the response he wanted because it looked good on TV, I'm sure. But I think that, you know, that was the thing that probably tipped him over the edge today. And he even continued in his written press conference with the Daily Newspaper Boys and with us Sunday Newspaper Boys. And he was very animated then. It was interesting to see from our point of view, but you can tell that the pressure is getting to him even at this early stage of the season.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. I mean, does this mean that he's actually struggling to deal with the season that Arsenal have had so far? I know he was at pains to point out that, you know, their last result in the Premier League, they're the only team to beat Leicester. And this season, this weekend, they're back to the Premier League against Manchester United, and the Champions League is a different competition. But, you know, that's really cutting it a bit fine, isn't it, to try and separate those two competitions like that?
But you know what? I mean, if they win this weekend against Manchester United, they're level on points at Manchester United, who go into this weekend top of the table. So I'd say a crisis is happening at Chelsea right now, but I wouldn't quite put the same thing, the same factor on this game on Sunday for Arsenal. But at the moment, every game that Wenger loses, that certain people or a lot of people in the public, you know, Arsenal fans and even some of the media have kind of decided that Wenger needs to go, and they're almost looking for an excuse to batter him. And events like Tuesday night, which was, let's be honest, a pretty dreadful performance, and the selection of Ospina over Cech, whether he's given Ospina the word, I think, that he's going to play in cup games. Now, whether that's the right thing to do for a manager, I don't know. He's bought a world-class goalkeeper and he leaves him on the bench, and the guy he picks throws one in the goal. It's hard to defend that, but he would argue that they're banging the title race, and pretty much anyone's in this title race at the moment, the way every team is playing so inconsistently. And if they do go into the international break on 16 points level with Manchester United, he'd argue that's been a reasonable start to the season. And I would guess he'd have a point there in a way.
Because the way the season has gone so far, Kevin, I mean, the results in the Premier League, I mean, a lot of the big teams have struggled at certain stages. You look at what's happening with Chelsea at the moment. You look at Louis van Gaal during certain stages, albeit they're doing pretty okay at the moment. And Wenger as well. And then you throw in Brendan Rodgers. And it does seem like, you know, there's a lot of frustration out there among the top managers, and a lot of guys are maybe looking over their shoulder.
Well, Wenger says often every game is a trial, every game has a judgment, and that seems to be the way it is at the moment. Pellegrini could do no wrong 2 or 3 weeks ago. Now people are saying, you know, what happens if he loses this weekend? What happens if he goes out of the Champions League? Brendan Rodgers basically probably, I mean, I'm of the opinion he probably should have gone last summer, and there's a lot of people feel he's an accident waiting to happen. And if he does lose on Sunday, you know, will Liverpool get rid of him? But again, Brendan Rodgers would argue they're going to be 2 points behind Manchester United if they win on Sunday. So is that a bad start to the season? Who knows? But I think no one's made a good start, basically. And you know, maybe aside from, sort of, let's say, Alan Pardew or Slaven Bilic, two managers with lower expectations, you wouldn't say anybody is secure at the moment. And that's a bizarre situation to be in. I often do a prediction each week for independent.ie, and trying to predict Premier League matches at the moment is an absolutely impossible dream, you know. So I think you just have to wait for all to settle down. But what we're seeing in the Champions League suggests that the quality of the Premier League this year is not quite there, and that might be why the Leicesters and the West Hams and the Crystal Palace are giving the top team so much problems.
Yeah, I mean, Alan, what do you think?
The quality is certainly not there. I agree with Kevin, and you see them every Saturday with the unpredictability in the results, Hugh, and that basically tells you that the quality is not there, because no way should clubs like Leicester, Swansea, West Ham, to a point, be taking points off the top teams the way we've seen so frequently so far this season. But just going back to the chat about Wenger and kind of the pressure that the managers are under now, Hugh, that is one issue I do have with in defence of the managers, is that it literally, their opinion changes from week to week. If you get a good result, they're flavour of the month. You get a bad result in the following week, all of a sudden they're under pressure to want them out. I think that's unfair on the managers. But then what doesn't help the managers is decisions like Wenger's on Wednesday night, when he signs a top class keeper in Czech, when everybody knows that they need a top class keeper. You're playing in the Champions League, you've already lost your first game away to Dynamo Zagreb, and he goes out and plays the sub keeper against Olympiacos in a game you're more or less half to win. So he doesn't help himself with these mad decisions either.
Kevin, what do you think about the Brendan Rodgers situation? If they should lose this weekend to Everton, do you think that he's in such a state now that he could be in trouble and pay for it with his job?
Well, he's become almost like a social media punchbag, and people are ridiculing him by the week. I don't know if you've seen the deluded Brendan account that's on Twitter.
Yeah, I have. It's absolutely priceless, I have to say.
It's great fun, and we've got a smug Sherwood as well, if you're interested in Aston Villa. But for 300,000 followers on deluded Brendan, that I was talking to the lad yesterday who's doing it. He's got T-shirts and cups and all kinds of things. He's running a merchandise business on the back of Brendan's mistakes. So I just think that Brendan Rodgers in the summer was you often say a manager reaches a tipping point. And I think, to be honest, he reached it at Stoke when they were 5-0 down at half-time. And I think that was the moment that the Liverpool board should have maybe, you know, taken the bold move to replace him. The one problem I think Rodgers has got is if there was nobody, often during a season, there's nobody out there to replace a top manager because they're all sort of tied up with other clubs. But you've got Carlo Ancelotti and you've got Jurgen Klopp hanging around the corner, and both of them haven't exactly said they're not interested in the Liverpool job. So I think that's the problem that Brendan's got. And I think if he loses on Sunday, even though 11 points that they've got at the moment, if they get up to 14, it wouldn't be the end of the world. I mean, I do think a lot of the fans have turned against him now. And you know, the tide of public opinion, which is swayed by social media these days, it seems to be the way things are going. I do think he'd be in trouble if he loses on Sunday.
Just quickly then, and I know we don't have a huge amount of time to go into this in more detail, but Alan's point there about the massive wages being paid to average enough players and the lack of connection, I suppose, between footballers and fans. Would you buy into that, Kevin? I mean, you see it week in, week out over there. What's your own feeling on it?
Absolutely. I mean, I shouldn't name names in a way, but Victor Wanyama during the year, I work with Southampton. I do their programme. I work with the manager in the programme notes and whatever else. And during the transfer window, he was kicking up on first training, which is the second transfer window in a row. He's been trying to do it now. Is he really desperate to go to Tottenham, or is his agent trying to push him to get that move? And you just wonder whether, you know, is £35,000 a week enough for somebody to live on? I would argue, yes, you could probably get by on that if you cut back on beans and bread. You could probably just about make ends meet on it. But the problem is that the whole game is not, that there's no real loyalty, there's no real kind of passion for the club anymore. It's all just to do with the next move and what's in it for me kind of thing. And I think a lot of the fans are being disenfranchised, and it's hard to love your club in a way when there's so many comings and goings, and nobody really cares for the badge anymore, as they would say, which is a sad state of affairs. But that's the reality when you're paying people who have got no really affiliation with your club and such huge money, and they don't really have a youth structure either that you have kids coming through that you might think you can associate with. And from my perspective, it'd be hard to support a team where there's five or six new players every year and people you've invested time and hopes in are just disappearing down the lane the minute somebody else comes in with a bigger offer.
Yeah, okay, listen, it's something we'll talk about again. Kevin, great to talk to you. Thanks many for your time.
Cheers, guys. Look after
yourself. Kevin Palmer there. You can read his stuff in the Sunday World and on ESPN.com as well. We're going to move on to rugby, though, because Joe Schmidt named his Ireland starting 15 to play Italy in the World Cup on Sunday. No Rob Kearney or Jared Payne because of injury, so Simon Zeba will stay in full back, and Keith Earls partners Robbie Henshaw in the centre. Joe spoke to Michael Corcoran earlier this afternoon. This is what he had to say.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, it took us a long time to break them down, and it was on the back of a yellow card that we got a little bit of scoreboard separation last time we played them in Rome. And you know, 2 years before that, they toppled us in Rome, and a number of the players are consistent, from 2 years ago. So, I think that's a real challenge for us. I think also the fact that they are in last chance saloon, effectively. They lost against France. They managed to win against Canada, and they'll be looking for a much improved performance. I think the Canadian team really challenged them on a number of fronts, and I think that's probably a good preparation for them.
In terms of your starting team, yes, Robbie Henshaw in, but unfortunately, Jared Payne and Rob Kearney out.
Yeah, I think with Jared, he should be right to train by Tuesday, but he hasn't trained fully this week at all. He's walking freely now, so the bruising is starting to go from the foot. We've had it scanned. Structurally, it's fine. So there's no risks with him. It's a discomfort thing, so he will bounce back and hopefully be available for next week, where Rob Kearney has made super progress. And, you know, we just felt it was a risk that we couldn't really afford to take if we added to the injury, and he missed you know, the rest of the tournament as a result.
A lot of competition for places in your starting team, particularly in the backs. Was that an area that you gave some additional thought to before you decided who was going to wear those jerseys?
Yeah, there's a number of guys. I think, you know, in the midfield, we did talk a fair bit about Darren Cave and Luke Fitzgerald as alternatives at 13. They both play 13. Luke had played 13 in the first match, so or had played 12 and had played 13 against Wales. So, you know, there were guys who'd had recent game time there. Keith had also played there, and we decided to keep him in there just on the back of Tommy's performance last week and Dave Carney's performance the week before and the week before that. So, you know, it's very difficult, but at the same time, you know, we felt that Darren Cave played really well last week and made a couple of line breaks and defensively was sound. And Luke Fitzgerald, just the energy and footwork and enthusiasm that he brings to the team, plus his ability in the air, it makes him really well equipped to cover a whole lot of positions. And so him coming off the bench is potentially a strength for us as well.
When you look at the Italian team, which has been named, I mean, Sergio Parisa, you know, in camp this week, obviously they've been looking after him for the last while. He comes back in, we don't know about his fitness, but he comes back in to wear jersey number 8. I mean, he's certainly he's the Paul O'Connell, if I can call him that, for the Italian team.
Yeah, he is. I think he is the talisman for them. I think a lot of their team was relatively predictable. I think we'd predicted that Ghirardini wouldn't make it, but we've got a massive respect for Minici. I think he's a really dynamic player. He's a little bit a mix between Sean Cronin and probably Richard Strauss, where he's both robust and dynamic. And the rest of the team is sort of picks itself. And at the same time, the excitement machine that Campagnaro is and the athletic abilities of Sato, experience of Garcia in the middle. I think we're up for a really tough challenge.
Just a final question. I mean, you're one game away from making the quarterfinal of this Rugby World Cup, but I mean, your neck is on the line every time you go and play from now on.
Yeah, thanks, Corky. It's nice to know that.
I don't mean yours.
Yeah, well, you know, effectively it is. I think the players are a little bit conscious of that, but one of the things is that we operate in a little bit of a bubble. We're not too conscious of what happens externally. We just work away and try to be as good as we can be. And we know we have to be as good as we can be to make sure that we have the best chance of getting the result, because there are so many variables we don't control. The bounce of the ball, the decision that gets made, you know, there's those variables we don't control that make sport probably the, you know, the challenging thing that it is, because we want to control as many things as we can, and so we'll attempt to do that, and we'll attempt to do them as well as we can to give ourselves the best chance of the result.
Yeah, it's Ireland rugby coach Joe Schmidt speaking to Michael Corcoran after the team announcement earlier this afternoon. Reggie Corrigan is on the line. Hi, Reg. Can you hear me okay?
I can indeed.
Super, got you loud and clear there. Okay, what do you think of this Ireland team, first of all, Reggie? Is it about as you expected, considering the injuries that we have?
Probably. I mean, it's quite exciting, to be honest with you. I'm really looking forward to how that centre combination works. One thing, I've been lucky enough to be over at the last two games, and one thing that struck me is just how sharp Earls looks at the moment. I mean, his speed across the first 5 metres is incredible, and I think for him, you know, being involved in that centre partnership and probably getting a little bit more space on that outside channel, I think he can do some real damage. So I'm excited to see how that works out. Jack McGrath in the front row as well, starting. I think that's probably a clever enough move, given that Keane started last week and you can bring Keane on from the bench. And the pack is very strong. I mean, it's a very strong, solid Irish team, albeit because of a couple of injuries. They've had to juggle it a little bit, but there's no weaknesses there as a result of it.
It'll be interesting to see what happens if Zeebo and Earls have brilliant games again, and then you're faced with a situation next week against France that Rob Kearney's back fit, Jared Payne is back fit. I'd love to know what Joe Schmidt is thinking. Obviously, we have to wait and see how they perform, but they've just been playing so well, Reggie, that you just wonder, are they forcing the coach's hand somewhat?
Yes, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's a serious headache for Joe Schmidt, one I'm sure he loves to have. But the physicality of the French game might well come into it as well, though. You might look at the two people that you mentioned and just wonder maybe in a more physical encounter with someone like Rob Kearney be better in that full-back slot. Dave Kearney has been incredible at the moment, and one would think that he's got a very, very good chance of being in that starting lineup. And then again, we saw Tommy Bow last week put in a brilliant performance, given the pressure he was under coming into the game. He put in a really good performance, and again, his physicality and size could be a factor in the French game. You know, if Earls completely stands out in that centre position and sets the world on fire, it could well be that Payne is under pressure for that reason. They might look to go for the more attacking threat, but you do have to think about the physicality in there in that centre combination with the French, and obviously Bastereau being there too. It's hard to know. He might have to look at the physicality and pick on size.
Okay. Look, you've had plenty of battles against Italy over the years. I mean, they always, listening to the Irish players, they've always put up a very confrontational challenge, if you like, and particularly in the pack. But I'm looking at this Italy team, Reggie, and I'm just wondering, are they a faded force now? Are they the same kind of challenge that they might have presented maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, coaches never like to talk too much in a disrespectful way about the opposition. But I think the reality of the situation has to be faced, and that is that Italy are not the force that they once were. Parise is coming back after an injury. He's been in Paris for the last number of weeks. We've no idea where he is, and so much depends on his ability and that whole Italian team build themselves around that. But in my opinion, they're not the force they once were. They're somewhat spent. And if we're going to be honest about it, Ireland are a team that I feel can certainly make the semi-finals of this World Cup. And if they are to be that team and fulfil what their very much potential is, then they've got to bat away the likes of Italy quite easily. It'll be a battle for 50, 60 minutes, let's say. But you'd like to think that there's definitely the strength within that whole squad to pull away from them in the last 20. And I would be very disappointed if we don't win quite comfortably on Sunday.
Okay, listen, England have to beat Australia on Saturday night. And, you know, in many ways, obviously we're looking forward to the Ireland game, but I can't wait for this one for so many different reasons, Reggie. Do you think that England are favourites with the bookies? And I'm struggling to justify why that's the case, just based on how good Australia have been. You know, even in the Rugby Championship, they beat New Zealand and Sydney. They look very good when they've had to, and how England threw it away last weekend against Wales. How do you see this one going?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I don't struggle to see them as favourites. I'd have to agree with the bookies on that one. I've been impressed with England's pre-World Cup, and I was impressed with a lot of the things that they did do during the World Cup in certain areas. I mean, the first game against Fiji was one of the most physical battles you're ever likely to see. They managed that quite well, and they were patient, and they didn't panic. And in the end, you know, they just grinded out the win in the way that they do. Now, the one thing I have noticed about England is, in my opinion, they seem to be a bit of a 60-minute team at the moment. They're dominating sides, they're doing quite well, and then they just seem to lose focus for that 20-minute period. And that was certainly the case against Wales. There's no way on earth they should have lost that game against Wales.
Yeah.
And huge credit to Wales for battling and doing what they did. But it does have to be said that England were in control of that game, and they should never have let it slip from their grasp the way that they did. Now, I've been over in the UK and I've felt the atmosphere and I've felt the tension that's amongst the English public and the pressure that's on that English team to perform. They know they have to win on Saturday. Australia have been very impressive. You're correct in what you're saying. But I just have this feeling that England are going to come out on Saturday in that game. It's going to be a cracker, but I just feel that the power of the support behind them, the fact that it's a home competition for them and all of that pressure that the players have been receiving all week and the abuse, let's be honest, they've been getting from the media circles for throwing that game away against Wales. I think they're going to bounce back very, very strongly on Saturday, and I'm predicting an English win.
I hope not. I have a few quid in Australia, so I hope you're wrong.
Listen, Hugh, for the good of the competition, trust me, we need England involved in this for a little bit longer.
Yeah.
They are a great team. They're great hosts. It is a brilliant tournament. I can't even begin to explain to you the atmosphere that's going on over in these matches at the moment. The two games, Wembley in particular last week, it was just phenomenal. And we need that competition to have the hosts in it a little bit longer. Not till the very end maybe, but definitely a little bit longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, listen, Reggie, thanks a million for your time. Enjoy the weekend. Thanks a lot.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, guys.
Super stuff. Reggie Corrigan there, of course, former Ireland international. Interesting. I was talking to Gary about this last night, and I said, look, you do actually need England to stay in this World Cup for the whole atmosphere. But I still think Australia are going to beat them.
But I actually agree with you on both of them, to be honest with you, Hugh. I think we do need England. And so far, looking at the games, the places look brilliant. The stadiums, the whole spectacle itself looks absolutely brilliant. But what would worry me, and I pick up on Reggie's point, it's okay saying the crowd behind him and all things like that. But when you look at last week, what happened to them when Wales got back into the game and the way they crumbled, that would worry me, Hugh, because if Australia go ahead at all and you can feel the tension and the pressure growing even more, I think it could have a negative impact on them with the pressure that's under them. So I'd
and
fancy
they did the same thing to Ireland, and you have to wonder, is it the heads going missing or is it physical fitness? They're actually struggling with the last 20 minutes.
It's a bit of both, but the one that I would worry most about is once your head goes mentally, that's when your decision making starts turning into what we've seen last week, giving away stupid penalties. So that's why I'd fancy Australia myself.
Yeah. No George Ford either. They've gone with Farrell. Anyway, let's go to Pat McCullough staying with rugby because second half well underway now at Thomond Park, Munster against Glasgow. How we fix, Pat?
Yes, we've 9 minutes remaining here and the 4-1 outsiders, Glasgow certainly putting it up to Munster. In fact, they led up to just a few minutes ago because it was 13-9. Remember, Munster leading at half-time. Dave O'Callaghan try with Ian Keatley adding the points on 8 points in all. And Rory Clegg scoring 3 penalties for Glasgow. But in the second half, Clegg made it 6-6. And briefly, Glasgow led 18-13. And then, well, a surprise try because of BJ Botha. He stretched to just touchdown over the line for a try for Munster to level the match at 18 points each, with Keatley adding the conversion. So we played 72 minutes here at Thomond Park. Remember, Glasgow in the past have won here in 2014. They won in the Pro 12 final. In fact, they've beat Munster on 4 of the last 5 occasions, but they really are a depleted squad here tonight. Munster are just ahead. Played 72 minutes. It's Munster 20, Glasgow 18.
Super stuff, Pat. Plenty of time for Munster to score 2 more tries. Let's go over to Oriel Park because it's 10 minutes gone between Dundalk and Longford in the semi-finals of the FAI Ford Cup. Placing the final up for grabs, and Dundalk still chasing that double. Sean Perry is there. Hiya, Sean.
Hi, Hugh. Yes, indeed. Well, Dundalk had the best chance of the opening stages here at Oriel Park. It fell to Kieran Kilduff, but he fluffed his lines after just 5 minutes and dragged his shot wide, volleying across Paul Skinner's goal. The striker could barely believe the time and space in which he found himself after an exquisite through ball by in-form fullback Sean Gannon. Well, the contest is, as you say, just over 10 minutes old. Kickoff delayed by a couple of minutes. Richie Towell now surging forward for Stephen Kenny's men. He's put it out to the flank where John Mountain is just about to square it. It's too close to the keeper. He's flicked it across Paul Skinner and getting out of jail there. But in the early stages, it's fair to say Longford Town don't look overawed. And at this stage, with just over 10 minutes on the clock, Dundalk have very often, in the course of this very successful season, often had a goal or two on the scoreboard. But Longford, an understrength Longford side, it must be said, Tony Cousins is hopeful of their chances. They were, of course, cup champions in 2003 and 2004, losing out in 2007. For Stephen Kenny's men, it's their third semi-final in 4 seasons. They are expected to prevail here this evening, but with 12 and a half minutes on the stopwatch, they haven't had a breakthrough yet. It's Dundalk 0, Longford Town 0.
Christoph, Sean, thanks so many for that. Dundalk will win that, won't they?
They should do, yeah. Yeah, I think Longford were 18-1 outsiders. And look,
18-1?
They were, yeah. In a two-horse race, it's massive.
It's worth the Euro, isn't it?
Look, you never know. Cup football, semi-finals, anything can happen, but I'd be shocked if Dundalk don't win that.
Let's see if Liam Nash has an 18-1 nap for us at the Ark this weekend. We're going to take a break and we're back after these. And you're very welcome back. 5-1-5-5-2. If you fancy anything this weekend, still no score at Oriel Park where Dundalk are taking on Longford Town. Johnny Ward is in Dundalk Racecourse. What are you doing there, Johnny?
I'm trying to work. I also had a leg and a horse that finished a dead heat second. Backed him to win tonight. I backed him each way the last couple of times and he wasn't placed either time. So I'm slightly happy, slightly frustrated, you.
Okay, good stuff. It was IA Skipper, was it?
It was indeed. You're not on the ball tonight.
No, I wasn't. Actually, I watched him run the last day, last week, in fact, and I had him each way and he didn't do me any favours there. And I just, I don't know why I didn't spot him running today. So, yeah, okay.
Well, I'm a great man for tipping after a race and I thought he'd run well today.
Okay, right. Stay with us if you can. Johnny, Liam is on the line, as he is every Friday night. Hi, Liam.
Hi, Hugh.
Look, it's all about France and Longchamp this weekend, Liam, and Super Sunday at Tipperary as well. No fewer than 7 Group 1s, though, at Longchamp. And, of course, the highlight is the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe. You think this is the best middle distance race in the world, Liam?
I do, and I think it for many years now. The King George used rival it to an extent at Ascot in July or whenever it was, but you get the cream of middle distance horses here. Unfortunately, we don't have any Japanese contenders this year, which we've had over the past couple of years, but this is the top of the tree as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, Trev Johnny Ward is aiming to become the first horse in history to win the Ark three times. A short price to do it, and well supported, and seems to have a very good draw. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she'll win. I absolutely loved her run in her prep, the last day of prep, albeit in a Group 1. I thought her performance last year was absolutely extraordinary. And she came into that with, you know, she was maybe under a bit of a cloud. She comes into this race this year after a beautiful prep. She was extraordinarily impressive. And one of the bizarre facts about Trev is my motivator, who wouldn't have that many horses in these parts, has the odd one. And Motivator was actually the top stallion in France last year with a sum total of 5 individual winners. And that's all based on Trev because of her prize money. And she's an absolute beaut of a mare, and I really think she should win.
Okay, Liam. Well, I mean, I've been looking at the ground all week because one of the lads is heading over. He actually flew out today, Barry, from the sports department. And he was telling me there hasn't been any rain all week long. I wonder how that will affect Trev. You also look at the likes of John Gosling's horse, Golden Horn, of course. We saw at Leopardstown last time out. And then there's a couple of interesting ones as well. Found for Aidan O'Brien, who's going to get a bit of weight because obviously she's of the fairer sex, and Free Eagle, who was hampered when losing to Golden Horn. So how do you see this one, Liam?
Well, first of all of those, Trev is the least ground dependent of the whole lot of them, so that's in her favour. Number two, I think she's drawn she's drawn 8, and you can't say the same about Golden Horn because he's drawn 14. It can't be a plus, but it may not be the kind of negative that a lot of people are making it out to be. But the fact that Paris has been dry all week is certainly into Golden Horn's advantage. The day of the Champions weekend, I was at the Curragh and watching the trials with a bookmaker, and we watched the Preniel, and New Bay was so impressive winning that, and he turned to me and he says, there's the Ark winner. Wow. Now, I just happened to meet him completely by coincidence when the Prix Vermeil came up half an hour later, whatever it was, and Trev was absolutely brilliant, and he says, wow, that's the Ark winner. So in the space
there's
of
the forecast there for you, Liam.
How can you go beyond that? But I can't see beyond Trev if she brings what she looked to have, if it's possible, to have even improved there. She was really brilliant, and her sectionals were amazing, judging by by time form. So I think it's between the top three, Free Eagle and Found. I just don't think they're up to that, and I can't see beyond Trev, Golden Horn and New Bay. And I am still a great Golden Horn fan. I know he has been very busy. It's the one thing that's kind of turned me off it a bit. But at 5-1, I think Golden Horn is an each way bet to nothing.
Yeah, Johnny, you get your money back if Golden Horn finishes in the top three. And on the evidence that we have, I mean, in terms of the ratings that the horse has, I just think that's a decent bet. And take your chances that Trev doesn't have a good race.
I don't fancy him at all, to be honest. He's drawn 14. Now, he obviously won a, what you could consider a very good trial for the race at Leopardstown, but it's going to be really tricky from that draw in a big field like this. The draw has killed so many horses in this race. And basically, her performance last year, and her trainer basically is of the opinion that she's in pretty much the same, if not better, form. Golden Horn simply would not be good enough to match that. She's just, I think she's just that bit too good. If he were drawn 3 or 4, he might be able to get handy, and he's probably fairly straightforward. But I totally agree with Liam about the Irish horses. They're closely enough matched with Golden Horn. If you look at the interference that Free Eagle suffered at Leopardstown, it was pretty dramatic. Now, it really was dramatic.
Yeah.
But you couldn't say he altogether strode out all that well afterwards. I'm not convinced he's a true mile and a half horse. And I wouldn't be that amazed if Found finished ahead of him, but you'd have to say Stamina is certainly a worry for her. She's out of a pretty sharp filly in Red Evie. And I think this is all about Trev, and it's going to be a great sight. I'm just disappointed I'm not going to be there, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Liam, the Prix Jean-Luc Lagardère, I should say, for two-year-old colts, that is. Three Irish in this one who probably should go close enough. Johannes Vermeer, Shogun, or Herald of Dawn. How do you see it?
Well, Ioannis Vermeer won the Day of Champions Day at Leopardstown and beat True Solitaire. And to be honest, I was a bit disappointed with True Solitaire. I had napped him at the Curragh last week, and I think he just proved that he's a stare. And to be honest, I think the form of Hell the Don, second to Air Force Blue, is better form. And he's about twice the price of Ioannis Vermeer. The question I'd be asking myself in the O'Brien camp is, Ioannis Vermeer better than Air Force Blue? If he is, he'll win. But I don't believe he is. And I think the value bet in the race is Hell the Don.
OK, Johnny, the filly's equivalent then will fly through with Ballydoyle running in this one in the pre-Marcel Boussac. Ballydoyle, I mean, obviously, huge amount of hype all season. The name, as regards to anything else. Do you think she has a good chance?
I do think she's a good chance. I wouldn't be mad on necessarily the Colts. I don't think, I certainly don't think Ioannis Vermeer is as good as Air Force Blue. And I don't think there's any Glen Eagles in the race, who obviously was thrown out of it last year when he finished first, I suppose. But on to Ballydoyle. I was talking to Shamie Heffernan after minding beat her at the Curragh the last time. He was pretty amazed, really, that she was good enough to beat her. And I think we'll see the true Ballydoyle here. I think the trip is going to suit her. She's no real excuse. I think she's a lovely, lovely, straightforward filly. And I think she'll take a hell of a lot of beating. I actually think she's around 9-1 for the Guineas next year. To me, it was an overreaction to her defeat at the Curragh. There'd be a slight concern if the ground were quite soft, but I don't think it'll be soft enough to blunt her. And I think she's probably a bet for the Guineas at this stage as well.
Okay, finally then, Liam, I'd love to see Sol Power, I have to say, in the Prix de l'Abbé. 4 furlongs, I mean, best kind of form, I suppose. Just if you look at results, I suppose it's come over 5 furlongs. But 4 furlongs, will that matter to Eddie Lynham's horse?
Well, this is always run. They run like the clappers in this one, and I think that'll suit him. The first time I went to the Arc, I didn't know the layout of Longchamp at all, and they were running in the Prix de l'Abbé, and it was over before I realised they run down the centre of the course. I was expecting them to go down disaster. The straight.
Absolute disaster.
Yeah. Disaster. But I think the strong pace will actually suit him. But Mecca's Angel display in the Nunthorpe is to me the best display of a sprinter all year, and while the ground, Mecca's Angel would like it pretty soft maybe, but it might be soft enough to have he do the business. And as I say, that run in the Nunthorpe is the best bit of sprinting all year, but Sol Power must be there or thereabouts.
Yeah, what do you think, Johnny, very quickly?
Yeah, obviously he did an absolute nightmare trip in the race last year. I'm delighted for Chris Hayes that he's maintained the mountain on the horse, and he just had a big winner at Dundalk here. And I think if he does get the breaks, he has his chance. I'm not 100% sure he's quite as good as he was maybe last year, but I think if he gets the break, he has a chance. He wouldn't want any cut in the ground.
Okay, your naps for the weekend then, Liam, if you don't mind.
Yeah, tomorrow at Newmarket, I fancy Waterloo Bridge for the O'Briens. He's going up to 7 furlongs, but I think he's capable of doing it. In the 4:15 at Longchamp, I expect Miss France to come back to form. And in the 4:50 on Sunday at Longchamp, I really fancy Le Mato.
Okay, great stuff. Liam's going to stay with us. Johnny, thanks for your time. Enjoy the weekend.
Yeah, just before I go, Colapier tomorrow, 10-1 at Gorham with Paddy Power, Grady Chueva.
Colapier.
Yeah, okay. I think she's won from 33 starts or something like that, but I expect her to go very, very close tomorrow. Great price.
Okay, super stuff. Gorham Park tomorrow, Colapier, 10-1. Thanks, Johnny. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks,
Johnny Ward there from the Racing Post. Liam's going to stay with us for the Punters' Council as well. Okay, and we have a small matter of a triathlon to tell you after the break.
Comedy with 2FM.
Animals don't have plans. They don't sit around with a 5-year plan.
Some animals, their fate sucks. Hey, little chicken, what are you going to be when you grow up? Oh, me? I'm going to be 12 McNuggets of somebody dropped in the street when they were drunk.
Hannibal Buress, the Comedy Camisado Tour. October 14th, live at Ficker Street. Tickets are on sale now. Presented by Aiken Promotions.
Comedy with 2FM.
2FM. Exploration is the engine of innovation. And it's through our exploration at Topaz that we have developed a powerful additive, scientifically proven to remove fuel waste deposits from within your engine, allowing for immediate injector flow improvement and preventing future deposit formation, meaning your engine will run smoother, cleaner, and further with every journey. Topaz. We go further. Learn more about our quality fuels at topaz.ie.
Okay, you're very welcome back. Now, last segment of the show before we hand over to the chart show. And Give It A Try is Ireland's first micro triathlon. It takes place during National Arthritis Week, which is October the 11th to be exact. And it includes a 3 kilometre walk, a 3K cycle, and then a 3-length swim. A brilliant way for people who suffer from this disease to take part in the sport. And one such person who's on the line is Peter Boyd. Hiya, Peter.
Good evening, you. How are you doing?
Great, not too bad, thanks. Listen, first of all, just tell us, if you can, you used to play for Dublin City, Robbie was telling me earlier on, and yeah, semi-professional footballer, and 4 years ago you were diagnosed with arthritis, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I was diagnosed 4 years ago. I'd say there's probably people around the country who I played with and against for Dublin City could probably ask me where you came up with the semi-professional and going, I don't remember his name and all that. But I was there. There is proof, and I did exist back in the day there in 2002. But certainly, yeah, about 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis. So, you know, still a young man in my mid-20s, and brought on a lot of change. Changes and a lot of things that were very different for me and from what I expected to do. And obviously with my background and having played at a decent level of football and well used to training and well used to being out and about and doing things like that, to then have to kind of cope with this new restrictions on what I could do physically and all the different training that I was able to do.
Yeah, so
it obviously made a big difference.
How did the diagnosis come about? Were you playing away and training as normal, and then you kind of realised maybe, you know, something wasn't right, you were starting to get sore? How did it happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose I'd begun to kind of come down the leagues just as I got older. I was playing Leinster Senior League and things like that, still playing ball. But like that, I just presumed I was tired. I picked up a few knocks. I was working in the pub at the same time. So, you know, I just presumed that I was working hard and I was training as often as I could and I was playing in matches. And, you know, you just presuming that was the bumps and knocks that you get playing ball. But unfortunately, it just began to take over and slowly but surely, you know, I realised that there was something more serious going on, and it was more complicated than what I could manage by just being looking after myself, so to speak. And then the pain and fatigue took over. I had to go down the route of going to my doctor. He sent me on to rheumatology, and then the diagnosis was made. But it can be a slow ill process while you're going through that, because you're not really sure exactly what's going on, and yeah, you know, it's something unusual for myself to have gone through. I did have my fair share of injuries. I didn't get the nickname a sick note for no good reason back in the day. But
here I'm looking at a sick note here opposite me here. This lad's been moaning about the last few years without your excuses as well. So listen, come here, just tell us when the triathlon's taking place and give us a detail for people who want to maybe think about getting involved or even just go down to support it. It's October the 11th.
It is indeed, yeah. So the one that I'd be involved with is in SportsLink on the Swords Road there on the 11th of October. So we're really looking forward to getting people back in. You know, like I said, I was someone who was very fit, very active, and then kind of this is a way for anyone, really. This is going to be for, you know, people who think they can do nothing, you know, just to get started. It's a participatory event. It's all about getting people involved. It'll be on the 11th. It starts from 9:30 in the morning. We'll be registering people. We want to get people registered online if we could through arthritisireland.ie.
Okay.
And you can follow the links there. And like you said in the intro there, it's all part of National Arthritis Week. So what we're looking to do is really raise the awareness so that people realise, you know, that there's people of all ages, all different men, women, children, the whole lot who have arthritis. And it's not just one cohort that it affects a lot of us. And we're just trying to raise awareness. And then, like I say, you get the participatory bit of it that, you know, that you can give it a try. You become a triathlete, and so many people now are wanting to do their own bits of exercise and do things.
Okay.
We're saying that just because you have arthritis doesn't mean you can't succeed just the same as anybody else.
Okay, well, look, we wish you the best of luck with it. Hopefully it's a brilliant turnout and you manage to raise loads as well. And fair play to you, Peter, because obviously, you know, it can't be an easy thing to do. Get in touch with us and let us know how you get on, if you don't mind.
Absolutely, no problem at all. We'll let you know how it goes.
Brilliant. Arthritis.ie, arthritisireland, I should say, .ie. Peter Boyd, best of luck. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks very much indeed.
Cheers. Peter Boyd there. Okay, we're going to move on because the Punters Council were a little bit over time. Liam is on the line. Alan is with me. And Leon Blanche is here from Boyle Sports, as he is every Friday. Hi, Leon.
Good evening, Hugh. How are you? Well, I was here every Friday bar last Friday when I left the bloody phone in a taxi.
We won't tell you the story behind that because we don't have time, I'm sure. We're going to fly through. Patrick Linden is on because we none of the best came in last week, so he gets another go as well for St Francis Hospice in Raheny. Hiya, Patrick.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. Listen, here's our bets for you now. Alan Cawley's going to kick us off. Alan, what's your bet?
Yeah, just quickly here, we're against the clock, so I'm going to go Chelsea, Man City, Stoke City treble this weekend.
Okay, Chelsea, Man City and Stoke. What can you do, Leon?
Chelsea, Man City and Stoke. Look, because it's Alan Cawley tipping it up, I mean, he couldn't tip his own dinner. But look, it works at around 5-1. Just because it's Alan, I'm going to go 13-2
about the treble there. Big. My treble, Leon, if you don't mind, it's a rugby one. It's a double, in fact, I should say. It's Australia to beat the Palms tomorrow night. So Australia to beat England in the rugby. And Ireland minus 20 against the Italians this weekend.
I like it.
Well, Hugh, I hope to God you are correct, because that would be fantastic, knocking England out of the World Cup. Look, about 11-4. I'm feeling very generous this evening. I'll go 7-2 that double.
Oh, I like that. 7-2 the double. And Liam, what's your bet this weekend?
Very quickly, Longchamp Sunday, Le Mato in the Prix de la Forêt.
Oh, you like that horse.
Liam loves Le Mato.
Le Mato, what's the price, Liam?
Henry Candy's horse has a huge chance. 13-8. I'm going to go 2-1 bottle. And my own Boyle Boost. I think Ballyboyle will finally get her ground in Paris on Sunday. She's a 6-4 favourite. But go on, because Patrick is a good friend of mine and he's trying to raise some very, very important funds for a hospice. I'll go 9-4 Ballydoyle to win the Boussac.
9-4 by Ballydoyle. Okay, Francis, so you have Alan's Chelsea, Man City, Stoke treble. You have my rugby double, Australia and Ireland minus 20. Le Mato on Sunday for Liam at Longchamp, and then Sunday, I should say, who did you go for? Oh, sorry, Ballydoyle as well in Longchamp on Sunday. So what do you fancy for this weekend, Patrick?
I think Ballydoyle is, and if that generous man Leon has given me 9-4, I'm all over that.
Ballydoyle at 9-4 is the bet for the weekend. Have a super one, Leon. Thanks to me and Liam as well, and to our punter. We're going to go take a quick update from Sean Penny. Sean.
Well, Hugh, it's all happening at Oriel Park. Richie Towell has just hit the bar, but high-flying Dundalk have yet to make a breakthrough. Towell had the best chance before that when he whipped over a 14th-minute free kick. But with the contest 32 minutes old, it's still Dundalk 0, Longford Town 0.
OK, no score there. Pat McAuliffe, how did it finish up at Thomond Park?
78-minute penalty for Keatley has given Munster victory here. Of course, there were tries from David Callan and BJ Bota, but 13 points from Keatley saw Munster win 23 points to Glasgow's 21.
Okay, and that is the action-packed show. I think we just about squeezed it in with 5 minutes to spare.
That was the busiest show in the world.
I've got to go get a pint.
Happy weekend.
Thanks a million. Fair play, Mary and Alan. We're going to go to the best of the Eagles for the next hour with Alan McQuillan. Take it away, Al.
Game on.
Game on.
2FM.